It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Verrett. For undocumented immigrants, the American legal system can be mystifying, and the ever-present fear of deportation means that crimes committed against undocumented immigrants often go unreported. This is the subject of a recent Frontline documentary called Rape in the Fields.
According to a collaboration between Frontline, Univision, and the Center for Investigative Journalism, undocumented female workers in the United States are routinely the victims of sexual violence and harassment. And here with us to discuss the problem is the producer and director of the documentary, Andre Sadiel, and reporter Bernice Jung of the Center for Investigative Reporting. Their documentary is available in full at pbs.com/frontline and in Spanish at noticias.univision.com. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Well, Andres, let's start with you. How widespread is sexual violence against undocumented workers?
Well, the first thing is that we don't really know. We don't have any statistics to tell us how widespread sexual violence is in the agricultural industry for some very basic reasons. Mainly, nobody's keeping track. I mean, when you talk about sexual assault in general, the Department of Justice estimates that two-thirds of sexual assaults are never reported, and that's with the general public. So then when you take a population that may not speak English, is undocumented, the logic would seem to suggest that they'd be less likely to report. And then there's nobody keeping track of the agricultural industry in general. The only federal agency in charge of looking into this is the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, which can bring civil cases of sexual harassment, but isn't out there monitoring or doing their own audit. So they really rely on people coming forward to tell them. But if they're scared, they're not going to come forward. So we don't really know how big the problem is. But after a year of investigating and traveling across the country from California to Iowa to Florida to Washington State, everywhere we go, we spoke with women who said that this was happening to them. It was happening to everybody they knew. It was happening everywhere, and it had been happening for generations.
So it sounds like if the number is two-thirds go unreported in the general population, we're looking at numbers much higher among that population.
That's what we would expect. I mean, when we talk about all the reasons why an undocumented woman wouldn't report, of course, there's the language barriers, there's the fear of deportation, which means you're afraid of law enforcement. You don't want to go and talk to the police if that police officer is going to be working with immigration to deport you. Also, when you're in a rural setting, you have much less access to legal recourse. A lot of these women don't know their rights. They don't know that even if they are here without papers, they enjoy all the same rights as anybody who's an American citizen when it in terms of crimes to their body or even workers' rights. And they don't know their rights. So they don't know that it's wrong, and they don't know that they can report it, and they're scared.
One of the things that is so wrenching about this story to me as I watch this is that these are women and a population in general that is largely invisible. These are invisibles in our society, and we don't tend to think about them much as we, you know, eat our blueberries and go to the grocery store and, you know, feed our families on literally the fruits of their labors. And then you've got this epidemic of violence among them, sexual violence toward women, and it just becomes that more pernicious, that much harder to crack into and get a handle on what's happening.
Yeah, I mean, of course, the invisibility is what makes them so vulnerable, and the predators know this. Most of the time, in the cases that we've seen, their predators are their supervisors who, in many cases, are either they're smugglers, they brought them here, or they're in touch with their smugglers. So they know everything about these people. They know what villages they came from. They know their families. They know how much money they're in debt to the smugglers. And they basically are holding them captive, and they're telling them, if you complain about this, you're going to lose your job. You're going to get deported. I'm going to harm your family. So the perpetrators know how vulnerable and invisible they are. Now, again, having traveled across the country, one of the things that I was really surprised at is how hard these people work. I mean, trying to schedule interviews with these people when a lot of them are working 14, 16-hour shifts, night shifts, and all this is to put the food on our table. There's not a piece of food that any of us eat that hasn't somehow been touched by an undocumented worker, whether that's planning the food, picking the food, packing the food, slaughtering the food, processing the food. The majority, it seems like, from the research that we've done is being done by undocumented workers.
And Bernice, I want to help by putting faces on some of these women. Can you tell us some of their stories?
Sure. We really did meet some women who were undergoing some pretty stark experiences. There was a woman that I met in the Willamette Valley. She had filed a case along with her sister alleging sexual harassment and assault at the workplace. They worked at a tree farm. And one of the sisters actually was raped repeatedly by her supervisor with gardening shears held to her throat, and she was kind of forced into silence because of the need to keep her job, but also because her family worked at this tree farm. And so the supervisor not only threatened to physically harm her if she reported, you know, what was happening to her, but also threatened to fire her entire family. So these are the kinds of coercions that are in place that make it, you know, that facilitate this kind of abuse. There's, in addition to the issues related to immigration status, there's also these very kind of compelling financial tethers, as well as concerns about personal safety and the kind of financial livelihood of their families.
It's shocking, too, Bernice, that, you know, among these women, it's such a well-known phenomenon that they call it the Green Hotel.
That's right. The Bill Tamayo, who works for the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission and who has pursued a number of these cases in the kind of the western region of the United States, he, in the mid-90s, began to meet with agricultural advocates in the northern and central valley of California. And he asked them, well, you know, when it comes to workplace issues for farm workers, what are the main concerns here? And they came back to him and said, well, you know, rape in the field is something that we're contending with. Is this something that you can help us with? And that's where he began to hear the phrases, the Green Motel, and he also heard the phrases fields de calzón, or fields of panties, which is what some of the female farm workers were calling their workplace.
And Andres, tell us what happens when some of the women have begun to come forward and try to report these crimes. What happens?
Well, there's a whole range of things that happen. I mean, I think the most common thing is that there's some form of retaliation. Bernice and CIR did a great investigation looking at all the EEOC cases of sexual harassment in agriculture and found that a vast majority of them involve some sort of retaliation, meaning that you're either going to be demoted or you're going to get fired, or in some cases, some of the stories that have been coming out since the broadcast, we've been hearing tips about stories of people who spoke out and then were then deported, which is their worst fear. So they have a lot of retaliation they have to contend with. Now, for the women who are able to get some kind of legal recourse and they get to they get themselves to a rape crisis center or they get themselves to a lawyer who can help them, they're able to, we've seen women who file civil cases against employers. And this is an important distinction, that these are civil cases against employers for sexual harassment in the workplace. And a lot of these cases settle out of court for some sort of monetary damages. But in all the cases that we found, we don't see any of these civil cases also resulting in criminal charges. So even though a woman has claimed that she's been raped and the employer has paid some damages, the sheriff, the police department doesn't investigate and nobody goes to jail.
We're speaking right now with Frontline producer and director André Sariel and reporter Bernice Jung at the Center for Investigative Reporting about the recent documentary Rape in the Fields. Next, it's headlines, and then we'll hear more from them. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And now here's a look at some of the latest news from WPR reporter Kristen Durst.
The Arizona wildfire that killed 19 members of a firefighting crew on Sunday has burned nearly 130 homes and structures. Officials earlier had provided varying estimates ranging from 50 to 250 homes and other buildings lost in the small town of Yarnell. Hundreds of residents remain evacuated. Striking rail workers and officials of the Bay Area Rapid Transit are talking again and say progress was made during an overnight session. The three-day dispute has gummed up commutes across the San Francisco Bay Area. Key issues include salaries, pensions, health care, and safety. Governor Scott Walker says the country must remake a cumbersome immigration system, but he's disputing a published report saying he's endorsed a U.S. Senate-approved pathway to citizenship for those here illegally. In an editorial board interview, the potential 2016 Republican presidential candidate criticized barriers to foreign workers coming to the United States.
Thanks, Kristen. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our conversation with frontline producer and director Andre Sadiel and reporter Bernice Jung of the Center for Investigative Reporting. They worked on the recent documentary Rape in the Fields. And Andre, I want to pick up with what we were talking about. Now, you said that in these cases, there were often civil suits that went forward and there were damages that were awarded to these women, but that criminal charges were not, in fact, followed up upon. Why not? Why are we not seeing criminal cases brought against these people?
Well, again, we're just going back to sexual assault in general. You know, the same statistics that say that about 2/3 of sexual assaults are never reported. I believe something like less than 10% ever result in a criminal prosecution. It's very difficult to prosecute a sexual assault crime. There are often no witnesses. There's often no evidence. Even if somebody does get themselves to a facility to have a rape kit performed, often the rape kit will only show that there was sex, but then the other person might say, well, it was consensual, and then it becomes a he said, she said situation. So prosecuting sexual assault crimes in general is very difficult. Now, again, you add that extra layer of a lot of these women who might be here without papers, and the last thing that they want to do is go to the cops. They don't want to subject themselves to meeting with the authorities because they, a lot of times, fear the authorities. They've seen their family members get deported. They know people have been deported. They don't want to get deported, so they're not going to go anywhere near the cops. Now, that being said, after having looked at cases across the country, though we have started to see a very few number of criminal cases that have been coming out in California, where women have taken themselves to the sheriff to be able to prosecute. But that's, you know, one, maybe two cases out of a year-long investigation across the country. So it's very, very rare.
And, you know, Bernice, it's frustrating to watch because even after a civil suit wins some damages, the alleged perpetrators, they're still out there. And yet Frontline manages to track them down without that much fanfare. One guy you guys found on Facebook.
That's right. Going back to the case of the woman in the Willamette Valley, you know, where she was essentially raped multiple times by her supervisor, you know, there was never any criminal prosecution in that case. It was a case that settled, you know, in her favor and in the favor of her family members. And then what ended up happening is that she would run into her supervisor at Quinceañeras or at Walmart. And so there is this concern, this deep concern that not only is justice not being served, but there are ongoing personal safety issues.
So what do these women need to know about what their rights are, Andres?
Well, I think it goes back to the fact that every woman and every person here in this country has the same is protected under the laws of this land. So if you're a victim of a crime, no matter what your immigration status is, you can go to the police and report that crime, whether that's, you know, domestic violence or sexual assault or any other crime of that nature. I think one thing that a lot of people may not know about is that there are special visas that are called U visas, which can be issued to undocumented, mostly undocumented women of crime, victims of crime, so that specifically for these cases, so that they can be protected and be given a visa to stay in this country as long as they cooperate with law enforcement. And so that's supposed to be an added incentive for people to come forward. I mean, when we talk to, I mean, there's a big debate about immigration. Should people be here? Should they not be here? But when we talk to law enforcement across the board, they want people to come forward because it doesn't matter if the criminal is victimizing somebody with papers or not. That person's a criminal, and they could harm a citizen or not a citizen. So they want to get that person behind bars. So they're encouraging people to come forward, and these U visas are meant to be an incentive.
Well, you know, you talked about how there's not a scrap of food on our tables that hasn't been touched by undocumented workers. And I guess I'm wondering, is there anything that a consumer could do to try to bring more transparency and accountability to these farms and these ag outfits that are employing undocumented workers?
You know, that's a great question, and it's actually very difficult to answer that. You know, a lot of the companies that we look at, they produce, whether it's apples or almonds or eggs, all those products get distributed under a lot of different brand names, and it's very difficult to know. I mean, I challenge, next time you go to the grocery store, for instance, here in California, you can buy grapes, and they'll come in a bag, and it just says California grapes on it. I was out in grape fields where people were picking, and they put them from the vine into those bags, and you're in a field out in the middle of, outside of Bakersfield. You don't know where you are. You don't know who the company is. So it's very difficult to trace where these products come from. That being said, we've seen some innovative programs coming out of Florida, specifically through the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, where they have brokered a deal between the workers, the growers, and the buyers. In this case, the buyers are big companies like McDonald's and Taco Bell and Whole Foods, in which the program stipulates that all the food that's grown under the program is done under fair food practices in terms of wage and hour, how workers are treated, and has specifically anti-sexual harassment policies, so that by paying a little bit more, these companies are ensuring that those policies are in place. Now, when growers don't comply, and if there are complaints that come out about sexual harassment, for instance, then they can be kicked out of the program, and then they won't be able to sell to people like McDonald's or Taco Bell, who buy a lot of tomatoes. So then there's an economic incentive there to put these policies in place. This only program like that we've seen in the whole country.
And how's it taken off so far?
Well, so far, so good. I think in the few years that it's been running, there, when it first got started, there was a grower who was kicked out for not complying, and that there was also a supervisor who was reprimanded and fired. And we've also seen cases of women who feel more comfortable speaking out and have lodged more complaints. And there's also ongoing education of the women of their rights. And I think one of the most innovative parts of the program is that there's independent auditors who go out into the field to interview women about what's going on in the field. So far, so good.
That's encouraging. And what about the American legal system? Do you get a sense, Bernice, of how motivated the American legal system is to crack down on this and have more accountability?
Well, we have been in touch with district attorneys and prosecutors, and, you know, they do express interest, to some degree frustration, with not being able to pursue some of these cases. Similarly, sheriffs and police departments are taking this issue seriously on many fronts. But there are also those where sometimes you know, there isn't enough training and there's not enough awareness of this issue. One example I can offer is that there's a Washington State case that I'm looking at currently, and there are concerns that perhaps the sheriff in that case didn't thoroughly investigate the case because he didn't fully believe that this kind of thing could happen. And so I think those are the places where increased training, increased exposure to this issue could begin to, you know, address some of the shortcomings with the current way that these cases are processed in the legal system.
Now, these women that you profiled, and many of them spoke up. I mean, they had you to be in your documentary. Where are they now? Did they find better situations? Did it help them to speak out like this?
I think, you know, on a case-by-case basis, I know some of the women just continue working in the same fields, and some of the women that we profiled in a case up in Washington State, I think there's, you know, it's time to start looking for some more work. So I think the concern that a lot of them have is by speaking out, are they going to be blacklisted, so to speak? We had some cases here in California where some women complained, and then it turned out later they ended up on a blacklist and they weren't able to find work anymore. So there's definitely that concern. You know, the piece aired last week, so we're still waiting to see what happens with these women's lives. You know, they were very courageous in speaking out, and they took chances that a lot of other women didn't want to take.
What is your biggest hope, Bernice, for what this documentary will achieve?
Well, I think ultimately, as you framed it at the outset, this is, you know, the lives of farm workers are really overlooked, often in the shadows. And I think beginning to kind of peel back the covers a little bit to see what is actually happening in the fields and what the day-to-day life is like for this really crucial workforce is my biggest hope. I think that, in addition to the issues related to sexual harassment and assault, there are a number of very challenging labor issues that these workers contend with. And so I hope that, growers, other farm workers, government entities, and law enforcement begin to really recognize this as a serious issue that we need to kind of put our heads together and figure out a way to make sure that women, when they go to work, regardless whether it's in the field or, in an office, we are guaranteed some kind of basic personal safety.
And Andres, we've got about 30 seconds. What about you?
I think that mostly, raising the awareness and hoping that there'd be some more research and more reporting going on this issue. One of the things that we confronted when we first started looking at this is that there are no numbers. There are no statistics. Nobody knew. Even the organization in California that's performing the majority of sexual harassment trainings for agricultural supervisors doesn't know how big the problem is. So I'm hoping that with some increased awareness, we can do some more research and really try to find out how big this problem is.
All right. Well, thank you both so much. It's been a pleasure talking with you. I appreciate the efforts of your film.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that was Andre Sadiel and Bernice Jung, and they are of the documentary Rape in the Fields. Their documentary was a collaboration between Frontline, Univision, and the Center for Investigative Reporting. It's available in full at pbs.com/frontline and in Spanish at noticias.univision.com.
Coming up next is the news, and then we'll hear about a new study that's been following the increase in the number of single-father households in the United States. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert, and you've been listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. There's more to come. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, we'll talk about zombies that actually exist in nature with the author of How to Make a Zombie. He'll tell us how certain bug species use what he calls zombie nannies to raise their young.
And here we thought humans invented zombies.
Well, it turns out bug zombies are really gross, too.
First, we'll look at the rise of single-father households. A new Pew Research Center study shows that the number of single-father families has risen ninefold over the last 50 years.
According to the study, that's twice the rise of single-mother families.
Barbara Risman, senior scholar at the Council on Contemporary Families, is here to break down these numbers for us and to let us know what this change means for American society. Barbara, welcome.
Well, I'm glad to be here.
Well, first, let's take a look at this study. Just how big is this jump in the numbers of single dad households?
I think we do have a real major jump in the number of single fathers raising children. I'm a little concerned that the study that came out today overestimates just how big that jump is, because it includes in this rise of single fathers who are living with cohabiting partners raising children. It doesn't make clear if those partners are the mothers of those children, but in fact, many of them are, we know from other research. And so that I think it's a sleight of hand to call a man living with the mother of his children who doesn't happen to be legally married to her a single father. And those kind of men represent 41% of this increase. So that my caution is that there has been an increase, but I think we have to be really careful in the language that we use and whether or not we want to call men who are living with the mothers of their children single fathers.
Well, do we know how many of that group are single fathers who are raising a child without living with a partner?
Yes, 60, if the other 41% are not, so the other, the majority are real single fathers.
The majority are.
And
this is a jump.
Are. I just wanted to make really clear that it's not quite the article claims that one quarter of all single parents are now single fathers, and that's only true if you include men who are living with the mother of their children as single fathers because they're not legally married, and I think that's a mistake.
Gotcha. And some of the numbers I read, though, I mean, they are compelling whether or not you factor in what you
Absolutely.
Just mentioned, something like in 1960, one in every 100 of these households was a single father household, and now it's one in every 8 or something like that. So there is a big raise that we're looking at.
Oh, there's absolutely a major shift. And I think it's a major shift that resembles and reflects the major shift in what fatherhood means in married couples as well, which is that fathers are no longer seen simply as the contributing to their children's well-being by bringing home a paycheck. They're also have come to be seen and see themselves as caregivers and nurturers as well as providers. And I think that as we have come to rightly define fathers as important for their children in ways beyond the economic, they fulfill that role both when they're married to the mother of those children and after they're married to the mother of those children.
And you know, it's interesting. I can think back to a year, maybe 2 years ago, there was some press about this trend of buffoonish dads being represented on TV, and the dads were always clueless, and it's sort of, you got the impression that fathers were not really all there when it came to raising families, at least in our imagination and popular culture. Is that changing?
I think that is changing, actually, and I think that as we see in everyday life, fathers bringing their kids to dance classes, showing up at PTA meetings, being the one responsible for good nutrition, that the popular culture will reflect those changes, even if they haven't done so. And there's something else I wanted to mention in terms of numbers. I started out by saying that the numbers here are really inflated because they include men who cohabit with the mothers of their children. But in some ways, it underestimates the number of men involved in child care because it doesn't include men who are in joint custody relationships, whose children live with them some of the time, but not all of the time. And there are more and more of them as well in post-divorce households. So that even though it undercounts, it exaggerates the number of fathers in some ways, I think it undercounts it in others.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, you wonder, I guess, does this reflect a new parental choice that's taking effect, that dads maybe are choosing in some scenarios, that they're the ones who want to have custody of the kids? Or is this just something that we're seeing that's arising out of economic and life necessity?
I think that it's I think that it reflects fathers choosing different roles in their children's lives and choosing that when they're married as well as when they're divorced or after the relationships end. I think that it's part of a general convergence that we're seeing in society between men and women's roles. It used to be that men and women lived really different kinds of lives. Many women married, had children, withdrew from the labor force, and considered raising children their primary occupation. And their husbands doubled up on shifts and, you know, spent as much time in the labor force as they could to support their households. Now, women are far more likely to remain in the household, in the labor force, and men are far more likely to pick up more of the nurturing at home. And so I think that this is one manifestation of that kind of converging of men and women's lives that has been happening for, at least 50 years.
So on the flip side, does this mean that we're going to be seeing, or we are seeing, fewer single mother households?
Not really, at least not statistically yet, because we still have so many. What we're seeing is a counter trend, which is far more birth to single mothers that don't involve the fathers at all, right? Right now, we're about 40% of women who have children do so without being married. And so that even though men are more likely to be single fathers, women are still being increasingly likely to be mothers without fathers in their households. So that we have several different social trends happening at the same time. The fathers most likely to be single custodial fathers who are not actually living with the mother of the children are likely to be fathers after divorce. Fathers who once were married is my guess to the women and ended up with custody afterwards.
Well, this is a trend we're going to be watching, see where it plays out from here. Barbara Risman, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
That was Barbara Risman, head of the Sociology Department at the University of Illinois Chicago and a senior scholar at the Council on Contemporary Families.
Coming up next on Central Time, we'll talk to the author of How to Make a Zombie about accounts of zombieism that exist in nature. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Kristen Durst joins us now with a look at some headlines we're keeping an eye on.
The millions of protesters who filled city squares in Egypt calling for the ouster of President Mohamed Morsi have been cheering the announcement from the military that Morsi is being replaced. According to the announcement, the Islamist-backed constitution is being suspended and early elections will be scheduled. The move came after Morsi refused to meet the demands of protesters that he give up power. Russian President Vladimir Putin has signed a bill that sharply limits the adoption of Russian children by people from countries that allow same-sex marriage. The bill is the latest move by Russia to buck the Western trend toward greater acceptance of homosexuality. On Sunday, Putin approved a ban on giving children any information about gays. State agriculture officials are warning farmers that heavy rains following a wet spring in southern Wisconsin would lead to overflowing manure storage facilities. Water quality officials also say spreading manure on already saturated fields could lead to manure running off into nearby streams and lakes.
Thanks, Kristen. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Zombies are everywhere in our culture these days. They're on books, TV shows, video games.
And I just saw one of this summer's blockbusters, World War Z, centered on, yes, zombies. But our next guest says zombies actually exist in nature.
Well, as long as I don't have to fend one off with a shotgun, I'm okay with that.
Hopefully it won't come to that. We're mostly talking about insects and some other animals. They're examples of mind control, taking over another's body, especially in what our guest calls reproductive parasitism, or zombie nannies. Frank Swain is with us. He's the author of How to Make a Zombie, the Real Life and Death Science of Reanimation and Mind Control. He's here to explain how zombies exist in nature and why we find them so interesting. Frank, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Now, Frank, first of all, why is our culture and maybe why are you so into zombies?
Oh, that's a great question. I think zombies are probably the ultimate blank slate. I mean, with vampires or werewolves, there's a lot of a backstory that you have to kind of fill in. There's a lot of rules that you have to stick to. But zombies are very amenable to any plot. They pretty much can spring from, anything from radiation to viruses. And basically, they're cheap to film as well, aren't they? So it doesn't take much in the way of special effects to create a zombie film.
Now, in your book, you cover a lot of zombie ground. We're going to key in this interview on the insect world. And you talk a lot about reproductive parasitism, a five-letter, $5 phrase there. What is that?
So this is essentially a method that some animals will use to help their offspring get a better start in life. And just as flies might lay their eggs on some rotting meat so that, when the eggs hatch, there's a plentiful supply of food there. And that, an animal can push that even further and try to convince another animal to take control of it. So I think everyone, a lot of your listeners will be familiar with cuckoos, for example, who lay their eggs in the nests of other birds and then trust upon those other birds to raise them.
And you have, and not a lot of people can say this, I believe you have a favorite zombie parasitic insect, the emerald cockroach wasp. Tell us, how does that work? How does that zombify other parts of the animal kingdom?
The cockroach is a wonderful creature, a very beautiful, small, slender, shiny green wasp. And it, in particular, as the name suggests, it focuses on cockroaches. And what it will do is when it wants to lay an egg to reproduce, it will find a cockroach, sting it, which will temporarily paralyze the cockroach, which is a lot bigger than the wasp, but they're only very small. And it will use that small window to drive a second sting into the brain, or what passes for a brain in a cockroach. And once this happens, the cockroach rouses itself from the first sting. It's not paralyzed anymore. But it's not the same cockroach. It seems to have lost its sort of will. It doesn't run away. It doesn't really seem to have much of a will to do anything. And the wasp will then lay an egg on the abdomen of the cockroach, put it into a burrow and bury it. And when that egg hatches, the small larvae will burrow its way into this cockroach and begin to eat it from the inside out. And all this time, the cockroach doesn't try to do anything about it. It just sits there dumbly and waits for its eventual demise. So a very grisly little beast, the emerald cockroach wasp.
But and then what's going on there? I mean, it's affecting the, I'm not sure if cockroaches have brains per se, but it's affecting the nervous system, the decision-making process of the cockroach. How does that happen?
It's fascinating. If you the actual their legs are still operational, so we're not entirely sure would be the quick answer, but we know that the cockroaches, if they wanted to, they could run away, but for some reason they don't, and they've been sort of almost domesticated, if you want to put it that way, by this sting. So it's something that the wasp understands a lot better than we do, unfortunately.
And what a weird thing to evolve to do, to have this specific target that you sort of mind control and leave your young there to develop in their early phase.
Well, as I stated before, a lot of animals will leave their eggs near a food supply. So it's but the unfortunate part about that is that that food may rot or something else may come along and steal it before your offspring has a chance to hatch out and make use of it. So the obvious next step would be to lay your eggs on something that is still alive so that it stays fresh. But to do that, you need to convince it to play a role in this relationship. And obviously, that's not something that the animal that gets eaten is usually keen on. So you have to be quite persuasive in your techniques.
And the emerald cockroach wasp is not alone. There are other species who do this kind of thing?
Absolutely. There are more than we could possibly count. Another fantastic example would be a small Costa Rican wasp, which performs a similar feat on spiders. So it'll sting a spider, and again, this momentarily paralyzes the spider and gives it enough time to lay that egg on the spider's belly. And when this egg hatches, everything seems to continue as normal. The spider goes on building webs and catching flies. And all the time, this little wasp, the larvae, is sort of like a leech. It's latched on there, and it's sucking out the juices of the spider and helping itself to grow. But when it comes time for that larvae to pupate, to go into a cocoon and emerge as an adult wasp, that sort of transformation that insects undergo, something very, very strange happens, and that is that the spider begins to weave a web that is not like any web that the spider has ever done before. And it's not for the spider. This is a web that is in particular designed for the larvae. It is a crib, you might say, a little secure platform that's nice and safe in which that larvae can curl up and pupate and undergo its metamorphosis. And it's doing this at the behest of this parasite that's latched onto it. Somehow, that wasp larvae is feeding a venom, feeding a poison, some kind of drug into the spider, which changes the way that the spider spins a web. And again, we have no idea how they managed to do that.
And we're getting a little closer to a zombie sort of thing as we think of it. It's actually taking control of the behavior of this thing to help the host or help the wasp and not really caring about the future well-being of that spider.
Oh, absolutely. This is very much the final stages of that poor spider's life. As soon as it finishes the new web, this structure, then it'll finally kick the bucket. And the fascinating thing is that if you remove this larvae several days, once the web building begins, but before it's complete, the spider will go on building that strange web for a few days, and then it'll stop and it'll go back to its regular web building. So there's something in there, some kind of drug that's in that spider making it do that. But right now, we don't know what that is.
And now, outside the wasp family, what other are there? There's smaller parasites that might affect the behavior of other insects or animals.
Oh, absolutely. It runs the full gamut through the animal kingdom. And perhaps my favorite one is, do we have time to talk about toxoplasma?
Yes, please. Yeah.
Okay. Well, this is it's very popularized now. I think a lot of people may have heard of it already, but it's Toxoplasma gondii, which is a parasite of cats. And it'll infect just about anything warm-blooded. And it uses other animals to sort of spread itself around. But it can only complete its life cycle in a cat, and one of the favorite animals it uses to spread itself about is a mouse or a rat. Now, this is a bit of a problem, because if you have the bug and it's inside of a rat, it can't get out, it can't walk over to a cat. So how does it get back to a cat to complete its life cycle? Mice, they're not very fond. We've seen the Tom and Jerry films. They're not very fond of cats, and they try to stay away from them where possible. So to this end, we have a similar situation where Toxoplasma gondii will start to influence the brain of this rodent, and it will start behaving in ways that are very, very unusual. The mouse will come out during daytime. It will lose its fear of the smell of cat urine, for example, which mice are typically very, very terrified from. And it becomes a lot slower. Its reaction times are slower. It's bolder. It's more risk-taking. And all of these combined sort of reckless behaviors soon enough deliver it into the jaws of a passing cat. And that's the parasite's doing. But the fascinating thing is, as I mentioned earlier, these parasites will infect anything warm-blooded, and they get into humans. And we're starting to do experiments where we see people who have been exposed to Toxoplasma gondii, to this bug, show very, very subtle shifts in their behavior as well. Now, I hasten to add, this is no reason for anyone listening to go and throw their cat out or anything like that. You would only ever see these changes sort of on a population scale, but people do tend to become, say, more sociable, more risk-taking. Their reaction times are slightly slowed. So it's the parasite. It's doing the same thing to us as it would do to a mouse.
But it doesn't do them as much good, because we're not going to go out and get eaten, presumably by a cat,
exactly.
And help spread.
We're not the
unless we really work at it.
Exactly. This is it. Like I say, this is not something that that people would have to worry about. But it is a fantastic example of how your own behaviors, and what I often say to people when I tell them about this, is if you enjoy roller coasters, if you enjoy gambling, if you enjoy racing around in your car, potentially that might not be 100% you. There might be a very small part of that which is influenced by another organism. And I think for humans, that's a very unsettling idea. And that really gets to the core of our fascination with zombies, which is that they are like us. They move around. They walk and sometimes they talk. But they're not 100% human. That brain process has been subsumed by something else. And so it's endlessly fascinating.
Frank, thank you so much for joining us. We'll watch for Hollywood to option some of the chapters of your book.
Excellent. Well, I'll keep my fingers crossed.
All right. Thanks a lot for joining us. That was Frank Swain. He's author of How to Make a Zombie.
And coming up tomorrow on our July 4th edition of Central Time, we'll talk about the science of fireworks, the chemistry and the physics that make the big bangs and the bright lights.
So we can figure out why the show we enjoyed worked. That'll be fun. We'll also talk about the early days of the Wisconsin Territory, back before we became a state, and how we celebrated Independence Day in 1836.
And we'll solve the mystery of the Platteville M, that mysterious Platteville M, on our first Curious Wisconsin segment.
That's one I've been wondering about a lot, looking forward to that. That's all coming up tomorrow on Central Time.
Coming up after the news, we'll talk to field and stream editor Bill Heavey about his experience as a hunter-gatherer, foraging, fishing, and otherwise getting his food from nature. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Be sure to check out Central Time on Facebook and Twitter to keep tabs on what we're doing. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.